Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and I live in Wichita, Kansas. I am a Patreon supporter for Creative Control. I discovered Creative Control some years ago, I think maybe while looking for interviews with Tommy Stinson of The Replacements. And I stumbled across this conversation that Vish had with Tommy Stinson that was really insightful. Vish held his own. I think Tommy can be a little bit of a difficult interview at times. And it went really well, and it really got into some areas that I wasn't expecting. And I thought, gosh, I have to listen to more of this guy and his podcast. Yeah, sometimes I'm not necessarily a fan of the music or musicians that Vish will have on the show, but I always appreciate their creative process a little bit more. And more times than not, though, it does lead me to finding a new musical artist that I'm interested in, or to think a little bit differently about maybe some artists whose work I've overlooked. So, you know, go ahead, and if you've been waiting at all to support Vish and Creative Control, now is probably the best time to do it. I know as a public radio employee here in Kansas, listener-supported broadcasting, whether it's podcasts or radio itself, really isn't a thing of the past. It's actually very much a thing of both the present and the future. So, yay Vish, yay Creative Control.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Jim White and Guy Picciotto are each talented, influential, and prolific musicians and songwriters who are neighbors in New York City. Originally from Melbourne, Victoria, Australia, White is regarded as one of the most unique drummers of his generation, who has been called upon to work with many, many artists, and is a member of bands like Dirty Three and Scleurus White. Picciotto has had key roles in Washington, D.C. based bands like Rites of Spring and Fugazi, and is a notable producer who, in recent years, has been working a lot with White and Yorgos Scleurus and their powerfully uplifting duo, Scleurus White. For the first time in his creative life, Jim has written and recorded a solo album, which he co-produced with Guy. It's called All Hits Memories. It's out via Drag City Records on March 29th, 2024, and it prompted Jim, Guy, and me to reconvene, this time to have a pleasant conversation about things like drumming, our relationships with artifacts and memories in an age of informational saturation, experimenting with keyboards and music production, perspectives on Jim's idiosyncratic approach to drumming and ambient music, working in film and a lost soundtrack opportunity, tour plans, updates on new projects, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners just like you who follow and subscribe to this donor-driven podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, which is the primary and most reliable way for podcasters like me to make a living. And this is currently my only source of income. So if you're interested in supporting me and my work, please visit my Patreon if you have the means to do so today. Plus in-kind support from independent businesses like Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 849 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Jim White and Guy Picciotto, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hey, Jim, how's it going?
Good, Vish. How are you?
I'm well. It's nice to see you again. Where in the world are you today?
Nice to see you, too. I'm in New York at my home.
Lovely, lovely. It's a nice chandelier I see behind you there. It's a new...
Thank you.
Hey, last time you were on, it didn't look like this. The background's totally different. You got... I see a symbol. Maybe, it's beautiful.
Maybe it's in a different room. I've got a... I'm recording this for you now on the with a proper microphone. So I think it might be new since last time.
Yeah, that's very kind of you to do all that. And before we get too much further, congratulations on this beautiful new album, Jim.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. I can't wait to talk about it. Also on the line here, Guy, are you there?
I am here, Vish.
Nice to see you as always. How are you?
I'm very good, man. Thanks to see you as well. And thanks very much for having Jim and I on here to discuss the All Hits album.
Yeah, it's great. Every year you guys are on now. I think this is a nice tradition we've started. So yeah. I appreciate you being prolific enough.
We might have to make it biannual. It could be biannual or triannual. I mean, or it could be like a regular running bit on every show.
I just have you both just show up no matter who I'm talking to. Is that how
song
it would
by
work?
Song.
Like, kind of Ed McMahon it for you a little bit, you know? Could work.
Just walk-ons, just unplanned walk-ons. The guest is like, what? Guy and Jim are here. That would be great. We should do that.
And then maybe one day we'll just usurp you and you will no longer be involved in Creative Control and it'll just be Jim and my show.
I sense there was a nefarious end to this suggestion and I get it now. I'm being supplanted. That's great. Thanks, Guy. It's nice to have you on. Hey, by the way, congratulations to you too on this wonderful record.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So let's start. Let's begin with the beginning. Jim, where did the idea for this... I thought initially humorously titled album, All Hits, Memories. I thought, oh, that's funny. It's a solo album by a drummer. All Hits. That's really good. Then Memories gave me a bit of pause. We'll talk about that later. Let's just talk about how this idea even came about for you to make a solo record for the first time, I think, in your whole career, your whole life. Am I accurate thus far? This is the first solo record, Jim?
Correct.
Nice. So where did the idea come from?
I guess it's been there in the background for a long time. Kind of came out of Guy and I working together over these last many years now, and had the name pretty early and kind of realized, sort of learnt that it was going to be about memories and the idea of memories. And then we, you know, it wasn't like, okay, we're going to make a record and it's going to, we're going to start making a record now, we're going to finish. And then we've, you know, well, we did when we finished it, we did know it was finished, but it developed, you know?
Yeah. I was fumbling about to make some jokes about the title, but yeah, Memories gives it a certain poignancy. Why, when you say you had the title in mind already, what does it connote for you exactly?
I think it's like all hits, obviously, all hits, because, you know, they're going to be hits on the hit parade. They're all hits because, you know, we're hitting the thing. But I guess the simple way to say it is, you know, all hits, it's like a material, you know, material thing. And then memories, which may be a different category, you know?
Yeah.
So it's sort of like it all hits, it puts it in the material world. And then as soon as you make set music, you know, it kind of goes into this other, I guess, something to do with the brain and whatever, feel emotions. And memories is like, it seemed like as we started, you know, as people started saying, like yourself, what's a, as we started talking about it more and I started thinking about it more, I realized that going back a little bit, one idea I had was that what do I think about a scene and I remember this one thing, you know? Why do I remember that and not something else? And that's, you know, the answer is because it's a hit, you know, because it's just a memory is a memory, you know? I mean, it hits your psyche or your brain cells or something. So we don't really know why. But then that seems, you know, kind of parallel to music,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And dreams.
Yeah. Okay. So something about your psyche. I know that as I've gotten older, my memories get a little blurrier. Is that a realization you've had too? Like there's a, memories are weird, man. They're intangible, but we cling to them a little bit. And then for our own brains, they start to leave our brains. They start to leave our minds a little bit, or they distort. Have you had that experience?
Yeah. I mean, they were weird enough before, and now they're half, now they're, yeah, now they're receding into different things.
Yeah, I'm chuckling about it, but I feel like I've had this conversation with other people when they're leafing through a photo album. I sound very old when I say that because most people, when they leaf through a photo album now, they're looking at a computer or something. But it gets to the point where, you know, you see a photo of yourself as a child and you're familiar with that photo, but then the photo kind of supplants the memory. It replaces the, like, was, did I even do that? I only remember this because someone took a little photo of me when I was 4 years old. So photos and memories, I feel like, I don't have a real grand point here, Jim, but I just want to say I empathize with you. This notion of memories kind of flickering in our brain a little bit. I think that's maybe present in what you're saying. Is that fair?
I mean, the flickering isn't really, you know, sure, that's a thing, but, you know.
But I you kind of carry memories with you almost like, because they're like totems or, you know, and the anecdotalizing of your own past and your own memories also becomes like a positive and negative baggage that you carry with you, you know, and certain like incidents in your past or whatever become really salient, but they also change shape and they change meaning. And then as you explore them, as you get older, you start almost focusing on, you know, the B characters that maybe in your original anecdote you didn't have so much in your head. And then so it's a constant process of back and forth. And I feel like it, the record to me kind of almost transmits that same kind of thing. I've listened to it many times and I'm still pulling stuff from the record. So I feel like it kind of almost functions in the same way.
Yeah, and I know, Guy, you're pretty disengaged, from what I understand anyway, unless you have some burner accounts, you're pretty disengaged from social media. Social media, I think, has had a weird impact on our memories. Or the things we want to remember. I know when I first joined, I was like, why are all these people from my high school trying to be my friend? I never even talked to this person. But then you're like, did I? Now I'm confused. Maybe I was more of a, I played more of a role in their lives than I remember. You know what I mean? So I think technology is also affecting our technology and how we interact with it, I should say. I think is affecting our memory of what our lives were. Does that make sense to you, Guy?
I think it both supplants memory in some ways because it becomes like a repository that, so you don't have to, you know, like it's almost like social media becomes a hard drive to hold these memories, but it also cheapens them and makes, what I've noticed about a lot of, not just social media, but the availability of so much imagery, even from your own past or just from your own cultural past or the things that you really, I remember when I was young, to see a picture of, like, say, Iggy Pop or something like that felt so, you know, you just didn't get to see very many pictures. So they had this enormous violence and energy to them. But now it's like you could look at pictures of Iggy Pop from now until the time you go to bed. And at a certain point, it just flattens out. Yeah. You know, the idea that, like, that kind of history could feel flat just, you know, 40 years ago would have seemed impossible. But and yet now it's there is this kind of deadening effect of from that. I don't know. I mean, to me,
well,
a little bit.
Is it because of the saturation? Is that the main, like,
I think it's because of the saturation and the ease. I think both of those things. Yes.
Yeah, fair enough. So getting back to the title from your perspective, Guy, I appreciated Jim's response there. All hits memories. What does that connote for you and your role in this project?
Well, Jim, it's true that very early on he had the title, like almost from the very beginning. He had said to me, like, I would, you know, this was around, I don't know, maybe it was pre-pandemic, where he mentioned, you know, I'd like to think about a solo record, and it was a very exciting idea. And then very soon after that, he said, I have this idea for a title, All Hits Memories. And I think at the time we thought of that it could almost be a franchise, like All Hits, dot, dot, another thing, you know, All Hits This, All Hits Landscapes, All Hits This. But the memories one was so powerful and such a suggestive idea. And when we did come to the point where we were naming the songs and stuff like that, we really leaned into the concept of, you know, and Jim particularly did, because these are, it's from his associations and his life and his memories. So that became a really cool working umbrella to kind of conceive of the record, even while we were working on it. I mean, I don't think I've ever been in a band or been involved in a project where the title preceded the actual work on the record, but this was that case. And it really kind of informed, you know, not in a deliberate way, really, but just sort of like sat in our minds as, like, you know, a framing or something as we started the work on the record. And so, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question. But
no, it does. No, yeah. It does. So, Jim, you have the title conceived of before it sounds like you even hit record. To Guy's point, often a title for a project like this, it might be derived from a song lyric, or there might be a title track to, you know, an instrumental piece that ends up, there might be a title for an instrumental piece that serves as the title track. Did All Hits Memories guide you as you started to conceive of what these tunes might be? Just this umbrella concept, was it in the back of your mind as you played or conceived of what you wanted to lay down?
I mean, I don't think I thought of, I think it's like a idea, and then it's sort of it's in the air, and it's in a relationship with, like, you know, what you're doing, but it's not like, and now we're going to do a song about, you know, this or that, you know?
Sure, sure. Yeah, I just wonder, I don't know, I've sat down in recent years at a drum kit with no plan, and I just play for a while, and I don't know where it comes from. And I thought about how we would have this conversation, because I don't know how, I gather for the most part you would have sat down in the same manner, right, and just started playing, or did you have were any of these tunes, like, conceived of before you started playing? This is very hard to talk about on some level, but do you know where I'm kind of coming from?
Like, so sometimes I just sit down and I throw my limbs at the drum kit, if you want to put it like that. And then I start playing, and I, you know, and then immediately I've made the hit, and, you know, what feels good, I've learned over the years that if something feels good, it probably sounds good.
Yeah.
Or it sounds like something.
Yeah.
And then immediately I'm in a relationship with it. Like, am I going to record it? Or I'm going to keep it. But I don't really know. I'm not thinking about that. I'm just doing it.
Yeah.
But I'm immediately in a relationship. I'm already in the memory. It's already in the memory. It's already switched over to the memory section.
Hmm.
Right? And so then the name, All Hits Memories, I know what – I had that name already. And then I'm not thinking about it, but it's there, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not thinking about – sure, I mean, I could probably tell you why I hit my feet down in that pattern. Like, I could tell you, I mean, every phrase probably have a whole history of memories, you know, or not, you know.
Yeah.
Or, like, one song is, like, I went to Guy's early on and we were recording this one idea in, like, lots of different ways. Something, I don't know how at first, it's probably a pattern that I've known my whole life that I probably, and then we just did it. The one that ended up as a part of the song Marketplace, recorded lots of iterations of it, and that grew into that song, you know.
Yeah.
And then at some point I thought the drums might like to have a note next to them.
Yeah.
You know, let's see how the drums feel, the content of the drums, whatever that is. Let's see how they feel if I just hold down a note on the keyboard.
Right.
You know, I borrowed this Moog, which later on I bought, and would hold it down, a note. But then, you know, sounds really good. Start moving your hands around, your fingers around. It's actually one note at a time, monophonic. So,
yeah,
you know, and then, you know, you're in another, these little things that you hear on the record, you know. You know, then you hear it back and you're like, maybe it's late at night, or, you know, maybe it's come back from Geese, or, you know, and it feels like this, it feels like what it feels like, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Gee, I've noticed that there are, in terms of attribution, there are instances where Jim is credited as the sole songwriter, but there are occasions where you and him are credited together. Can you, and you know, Jim just alludes to the instrumentation he felt compelled to add to certain pieces. Can we talk a little bit about that from your perspective, when other instruments entered the picture, and again, your role in collaborating with Jim on these songs?
Yeah, we didn't really ever come up with for the listener who may not have heard this record yet, basically the record is an instrumental record. There's no vocals on it, but it's primarily keyboards and drums. And initially when we started working on the record, I think we were thinking maybe it would just be a drum record, you know. We hadn't really had a discussion about other instrumentation, yay or nay. So we started working on some stuff involving drums. And at the same time, Jim was learning how to engineer for himself. So we were working here in my studio, but he was also, there was periods of time where he was like living in Australia and not here. So we weren't able to work in the same room. So he was engineering his own drums and recording stuff and sending it to me. And then, so it kind of like, we have this like working process that's really a conversation, I think, a conversational mode of working, which I think is kind of our, you know, we discuss concepts, we kind of come up with ideas, we send things back and forth. There's no real set way of working. But for example, a song like Long Assemblage, for example, like I think for me, what we'd done, we had recorded a bunch of drum stuff here at the house. And at that point, I was thinking almost like, could we do like a symphonic build where the entire like orchestra is just drums, you know,
but
in different sections, and they can it be like arranged and layered so that this one cymbal part, which was recorded on its own, could be like a droning string section? And can this part be like, you know, a percussion section? And can this, almost thinking about it as like an orchestral build, but solely composed of drums and then shaped to have an arrangement or a, you know, like a mood that works. And it works like, what's interesting about these songs, to be honest with you, like I know that some of them we worked on together, some of them Jim recorded separately and then I added things to, some Jim just solely did by himself and then I mixed them. I mean, once songs become songs, it's like they step into their own identity at a certain point. So you don't even really, a lot of the times I have to go back and look at the sessions to even remember how they were created, because now they just seem self-evident, or they just seem to be organic in a way. Like once the song has been like, once you've gotten it to the place where you feel it as a piece of music, it assumes its own character. So like trying to like parse out how it was done, it's actually confusing for me now. So actually when I was like thinking about how to discuss this stuff, I have to go back and look at the sessions to even remember how they were constructed. And sometimes I'm really surprised by how constructed they are. And then sometimes I'm surprised by how little construction was involved, or how little like arrangement was done in the editing process. So it's a very mixed bag, but it's always this back and forth, this tennis game between Jim and I, where we're like sending ideas to each other, coming up with concepts. And I think one of the biggest things that I think both of us have been thinking a lot about is, like, particularly with Jim, like having been working with Jim for so long, the sound of his playing, the physical sound of his drums, like wanting to get like, look, I think about this in terms of being a guitar player. Like when you have an individual sound that you feel is like, you know, it's like it becomes you, and you become the sound in this weird way. Like it has to do with how you hit an instrument or how you play an instrument, the equipment that you use, the mechanics of it. There's all these things that go into making up a certain sound. But when you actually step into something which feels like uniquely your sound, and then you have this kind of agony of trying to get that recorded or get that, you know, evidenced. And when you're a young musician and you're just coming up and you're kind of leaving this sound that you have in your head to people who may or may not understand what you're doing and are trying to engineer it and do it, and you might not have the funds to really work on it that much, and suddenly it comes out and you feel alienated from your sound and you're always struggling to get somewhere. So I really feel like Jim has a very particular vision for his sound, and I think we share a lot of common feelings about the way certain drums can sound. And so, for example, his kick drum, like, I feel like we're getting closer and closer to this ideal kick drum. That it's not like a question of like a good kick drum sound. It's like his sound, or the sound that he hears in his head. And the more that he's become an engineer and learning how to craft it, the more like I feel like we're honing in on these things, and we can talk to each other in a language I think we both understand. We talk about, like, you know, the blackness behind the music, and we both agree on what that means, and silence and space and, you know, this kind of thing. You just develop a language of talking to each other that can sound pretentious maybe to other people, but to you it's like a way to communicate within the thing, and we've developed a way of talking about it. And I'm really happy with this record, because when I play it and I'm hearing a richness or a sound from the drums that has been something I feel like we've been working towards for a while. And it's just a satisfying process to kind of feel like, oh man, you know, I feel like it's always on the horizon, but when you feel like you're getting there, it's 'cause, you know, he's such a unique, idiosyncratic and beautiful drummer. And that sound is him, you know, is the sound. So,
yeah, I thought of that sound that you're describing on tunes like, No How, like just the way it begins with Jim and that kick drum. You're right, it's distinctively his. And I appreciate you also highlighting Long Assemblage, because I did perk my ear that, oh, wait a minute, that hi-hat pattern and whatever else is going on, that can't be the same guy. That's got to be a multi-track. Guy, just real briefly, is there a lot of multi-tracking? Or is that, you cited that specific song, is that the main example of it? Or is there a lot of multi-tracking of drums?
No, there is some multi-tracking of drums throughout the record. Not every song. Some songs are not that way, but there is layering, and often it's textural and sometimes it's like melodic. But no, there's quite a bit of that. And going back and looking at the sessions, I see there's more of it than I remembered. But that's been an idea of ours, like a way to kind of create builds or structures that are musical but also move, like, you know, and there's plenty of songs where they're based on improvisational playing or specifically catered playing. I mean, it's all kind of mixed together, but there is quite a bit of that. But it's, the idea behind it is, I feel like these are hits. It feels very musical to me, and the record, and there's multiple things going on. The songs within themselves are songs, and then there's the way the songs relate to each other in terms of the way the record is sequenced and the way the songs hand off to each other. That is also kind of very, very intentional and was a big part of the way the record works.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Jim, you heard Guy and I just now waxing poetic a little bit about your drumming. You know, every musician, for the most part, starts out playing on an instrument that billions of other people have played. And if you're lucky and you're talented enough, you develop a voice on it. And hearing Guy speak about your playing, reading Bill Callahan's beautiful essay about this record, I wonder if you have any perspective on what other people make of you as a player. And now that you have, you know, made a solo record, like, this is really, I think, in a way, asserting your voice. Maybe assertion's the wrong word, but, you know, this is really a lovely document of your playing. Back to my question, do you have a perspective on what other people make of your playing? And how would you characterize it? Why do you stand out, do you think?
I mean, one thing I would say is that this record is part of, because, you know, I think I did an interview and someone said, you know, so now you get to do this or something, you know what I mean? To me, it's just part of my whole playing music, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it certainly happened now for reasons, you know, but doesn't feel separate in terms of what people think about. I don't know.
It's a hard question. I didn't think you would field it well because, you know, I'm asking you to almost praise yourself, but as you ponder this record and what you came up with, like, did you learn things about yourself as a player? How about that?
I mean, I think, to going back to the original question, I think, you know, when I became more well known, it was in the guys of Dirty Three, you know, in the Dirty Three band, and you know that's a, you know, my sound developed in that band, and it was, you know, people sort of heard the language in that band. You know, that band had the idiosyncrasies and the space for us all to be how we are were. So I think that's been that was a great way to get sort of noticed. You know, when I hear this record. I mean, I love this. I really love this record, but you know, I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to say about that. I mean, I think going way back, you know, at one point a few years ago, I found a recording of pretty much my first band or second band, and we had it It was on video to VHS, and we transferred it. And you know, I listened to it. And I was like, man, what have I been doing all these years? It just sounds like me, you know.
Sounds like me. See, that's interesting.
Sounds like me.
That's
sounds like me then. I was 18 then. You know.
Yeah. I guess, so, is it possible?
I would have said, in my memory, I would have said I couldn't play at all, you know?
Right. Is it possible you don't know what distinguishes you as a drummer? I remember I saw you play with Guy and members of Silver Mount Zion in Toronto, and it was two nights. I think we've talked about this before, and Mary Margaret O'Hare was just beautiful couple of nights of music. And I think I came up to you and said, because I... at the time, fancied myself a drummer. And I said, Jim, like, your drumming's unbelievable. I don't even know how you do that. It was meant to be a compliment, but I think you were honestly curious. What do you mean? What do you mean you can't do that? Why can't you do it? And it's always stuck with me because I wondered if you didn't know. You can't be objective about what you're playing. That's probably a really natural thing. Like, when someone compliments you about something specific you're doing, Guy, you've probably had this too in your career where people are like, oh, my God. Great. You're so amazing. You're like, am I? I don't know. What am I doing? So am I? What do you mean? You honestly seemed to be curious about what I was getting at when I said I couldn't quite figure out what you were doing as a drummer myself. That's all I'm getting at. Right. I just wonder if you can be objective about that.
I don't know. I mean, I've got a lot of things I do, a lot of things that I do that I try to do that I like, you know, that I've developed. You know, I think each thing is new, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know, I remember when I was you know, learning to play drums, I kind of thought you had to program these sort of phrases into your body, like these stickings into your body, these phrases, you know, patterns, and then you do that into your unconscious, so that, because you know, that's what I was really inspired by, this guy Jeffrey Wagoner and this band Laughing Clowns and the Saints. I think we've talked about this before.
Yeah.
And this flow that they had. And, you know, so you kind of like learn this stuff and then you put it in there, and then I kind of thought you were supposed to have it, just let it come out, you know, bypassing your reasoning in a way. Mm. You know, and I kind of think that's, you know, you kind of, what it's like the name, like, you know, the name, but it's like not there in your forefront, but it's there, you know, and you're watching yourself. It all goes back to this, that it's material and not material at the same time, you know?
Mm. Yeah. So you referenced the fact, I think Guy did, and I'll go to Guy on this. You referenced the fact that this idea for a record was kicking around prior to the pandemic. Over the years that we've spoken about, Guy, your work with Sclerus White, we've discussed the fact that the album at hand may reflect years of material. Can we talk chronologically about when the material for All Hits Memories was actually, when it began to get captured, and when you actually started thinking this is a record? Guy, can you speak to that?
Yeah, I can. Like, but first I'd like to just say one thing about the thing you were just talking about in terms, because I think when you talk about people's, like, there's like technique,
yeah,
then there's attitude. And those are like kind of different things. Like, certainly Jim has techniques that he's developed and learned over the time, but he also has a really unique attitude towards the way he approaches his playing. And
yes.
And you know, there's like, when you play with people, you really learn about how they listen, how they feel time, how they surge and pull back, and how they, you know, how they know how to ride energy and stuff like that. So it's like, you can, you know, I've worked with a lot of different musicians, both in bands and also engineering and producing people. And you develop this like understanding, and, you know, you start to develop, just such a respect for what individuals bring to things. So I think the question you're asking Jim is a really complicated one, because it involves, there's so many things that that combine to create a musical personality and delivery. And this record, I think, is interesting because it's not only just drums. The thing that really blew my mind was when Jim started doing the keyboard stuff and adding the keyboards to the mix, because I didn't know him as an instrumentalist in that sense. And they're like vocals in a way, and they're also very like the sounds that he found and the choices that he made, yeah, and the patterns that he played and the placement of the patterns and the way that they sit with the drums and the way they speak to each other within the music. It was so thrilling when that started happening, because it was so unexpected when we started that would become such a feature of the record. But once it started working on it like that, it felt like so self-evident and so natural. And it wasn't like he was suddenly sitting down and playing Rachmaninoff and that he was, but it was the keyboards, what they did with the drums, you know, because I think I mentioned this to Jim, you know, ostensibly the piano is a percussion instrument, which is always like, you know, this thing I learned it very recently, and I always find it like, you know, a hilarious fact because it seems so strange, but it truly is, you know, when you think about, and I've always had a hard time with the piano because it doesn't have the looseness of a guitar or the strike, you know, there's something like almost mechanical about the pressing and the plate. So I've always like, the keyboards are something that I really love. And I've often tried to teach myself how to play, but I feel like I have some kind of a lack of facility with it. But I was so impressed with the way Jim just started pulling, you know, out of the Moog and out of the Korgs and finding these sounds and these approaches, and it was also fluid. It was that was really, really exciting. And I think the song which most kind of blew me away in that regard was July, because we had basically finished the record, but we knew we needed something else. And he just came up with this piece, and the keyboard line on that, it's almost like a stand-up bass,
it's a bass
or something. And
absolutely.
And yeah, it's so beautiful. Yeah. And the minute he sent it to me, I just had this like shiver. I was like, oh man, this is it. You know, this is the capstone to this pyramid that we've been building, you know, yeah, and just being responding so much to, and the element that I was really responding to was the keys, you know, yeah, it was like so lovely. And then the way it worked with the drums. So anyway, I just wanted to talk on that, but
I just
back
wanna,
to your other question.
I want to say, I appreciate what you're saying, because what you've both done here, and it sounds like Jim did some of this on his own, is he's created this kind of band dynamic for a solo record. Some of the keyboard parts, the layers, like one is sort of playing a bass part on occasion, and the other's playing a melody of some kind. And yeah, it just creates this, I don't know if this was the conception right from the get-go, that this would be not just drums, but I just want to say, and I don't know, maybe we should go back to Jim on this just for a second. Do you mind, Guy, if I just ask Jim?
No.
Okay. I guess this is my show. I can do whatever I want. Jim.
Well, it is for now.
For now, yes. We've established it might not be for long, and with good reason. Jim, talk about this a little bit, the introduction of these other elements and the fact that you're mostly playing them. I mean, did you have much facility with keyboards and whatnot prior to these sessions?
You know, I've got my things. I play around on a piano when they're there. But no, I'm not a keyboard player in any way. I just wanted, like I said before, I just wanted to put a tone on there, but then I found it so fun to make up these things. And what I was thinking about when Guy was talking about that stuff is that, and you know, certainly July was like the bass and the snare, and I was just trying out this microphone on the snare that like this really let it sing, and the whole thing took a few minutes. But some of the other ones, what I was thinking about was how learning Pro Tools and learning it not very well, you know, learning it as I was going along, I was really happy with how the Pro Tools felt just like another instrument.
Yeah.
So that the, you know, maybe the session was a bit messy. There was different ideas floating around. You could just, you know, like make, like construct, like when some of them are just played as is and then some are in the computer, but the computer was just another element of the flow of it, you know?
Yeah.
Which I was kind of happy to discover, you know?
It sounds like this means of expression has been building up for you for some time. Like, we were talking about a timeline on this, but maybe you've been thinking about this longer than that even. I don't know. You just seem like you have a lot of ideas swirling around, and we're lucky to have them now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like keyboards was a surprise, you know. Yeah, I mean, you know, and also, you know, it's also great to show them to Guy. Like, you know, I don't know, like, you know, I was pretty... I'm not a keyboard player, you know. I was pretty happy when they started working like this. It just happened, you know. But I mean, in terms of like thinking about the idea, I mean, you could go back to like I made this record with Nina and the Stars here many years ago, where I wanted the drums to do all the roles of the instruments, you know, like Nina and the Stars here plays acoustic guitar and singing, and then I wanted she had all these strings and these different instruments, and you know, kind of did that, and that really worked. And then, you know, between then and now, I did this thing with I went and saw this dancing once when Dirty Three and Cat Power were playing in California, and the lighting person was involved in the ballet orchestra kind of thing or whatever. We went down there to check it out and kind of had this real feeling about the bodies. It was like this piece where it was like just the bodies had this kind of feeling, like the lights on the bodies of these dancers felt like what you feel when you hear music, you know. Mm. So over the next few years, I sort of realized that there was this great dancer in my social mist, and you know, and Eve Sussman, and art, visual artist, and Claudia de Sopatores, and myself, we made this, you know, made this thing. And my idea, everyone had their own perspective, right, of what we were trying to do. But like my idea was like I wanted to have this sort of melody move between the voice, sorry, between the drums and the movement, and you know, I'm not talking about like accompanying it, like not like I'm talking about going linearly between them, you know. Mm. Whether that happened or not, I don't know. It became something else, as these things do, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so maybe that's answers your question about if it, you know, maybe it's in the air.
Yeah.
You know.
Hey, thanks for listening to Creative Control, as always. As you may have heard me mention, I recently lost my day job, and I've had a few conversations with people since who've said, you had a day job? I thought your podcast was your day job. When I explained why it hasn't been my day job to a friend, he suggested I should share some of this information with people like you listening right now. So, in short, unless they have some giant exclusive million-dollar contract, podcasters are not paid to make stuff by companies like Apple and Spotify. Podcasters do not make any money from streaming royalties. Ad revenue is dependent on a certain threshold of downloads each month, and even if your show is accessed 30,000 times a month, the income you get is actually really minimal. So podcasters like me usually make time in our lives to support our communities and our interests to make these shows, and our most reliable source of income for this work is in fact crowdfunding. In my case, it's my Patreon. So if you'd like to receive ad-free episodes earlier than everyone else, regular newsletters and blog posts, bonus audio content, and support my work, quite literally, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And I think also, don't you think, Guy, that like how we did Forest in Me and this record, I feel like I've always been in a band, like, you know, I've been a performer, you know, like the records are performances that we're capturing in some way or not, you know. But then I think with this record and Forest in Me, we kind of moved to a different, actually kind of studio, more studio thing, which I really like. Even though they're just moments, but they're not like band performances in the same way. It's opening, out.
And the Forest in Me is the Xyloris White record that came out on Drag City last year. And And that's Jim's band with George Tsouloris from Crete, where he plays the lute. And we've made, five, six records together at this point. But
yeah.
And with every record that we did with Tsouloris White, I think we felt like we were making advances and exploring different things. But I think we really felt like we crossed into a new space with The Forest in Me. And that record and this record share a lot of the same kind of loam or topsoil or something. You know, they kind of were generated around the same time. And we were working on them kind of almost simultaneously. And it was a point where, you know, we were assembling the two records and we had sequences and we were listening to them at the same time. So there's something like a similar kind of development. And I think a lot of it has to do certainly with Jim learning to engineer and taking on some of that stuff. And then also developing a relationship with the software and also kind of pushing me to learn more about the software, because that was also really helpful. And then, but also more almost psychologically, just finding a different, just different ways to source music or something. It was like, there's a certain kind of like openness or space that's in the music, and it's really been satisfying. So I think there's definitely this, they're like brothers, the two records in a way. And I think they speak to each other in kind of an interesting way, even though this is quite a distinct thing on its own. But so the timelines are very similar. Like, we started working on material for both at the end of 2019 and then into 2020 and then into the years that followed. I mean, like this record, I mean, some of the earliest material, I think, like Long Assemblage and parts of Marketplace and stuff like that, those were things that we were working on for a while early. And then there's like other pieces that were done, like July, for example, I think was the final thing that we did. And then, but there were certain moments I remember, like there was a moment when Jim was working on some stuff on his own and he sent me the song Curtains that starts the record. And there was this thrill that I had when I put it on, because the low end, the kind of rattle of the kick drum and the intense depth of the Moog sound, it was like shaking my speakers. And it was so like, all I could think about is like, if we can get this sound through the factory process of making a record, and if at the end of the day it'll still be this violent and shocking sounding, I'll be really, really happy, because you know, there's mastering and all the things you need to do to make the thing like viable and not, you know, throw the needle off the disc or whatever, you know, or like, you know, blow someone's brain apart. So we were like, I just was so excited by that thing that he sent. There were these moments where like, and that was one really exciting one where I was like listening, I was like, oh my god, this is so thrilling, you know. And And there's so many things in the record. Like, I just listened to it right before we talked because I wanted it to be really fresh in my head. And there's things with the hi-hat. Like, I have these – I love drums. I've always loved drums. I've played them, you know, myself, because when Fugazi used to practice in my parents' house and my bands before that, you know, there were always drums in the house. So I would go down there and play them. And I'm not – I never developed really as a drummer, but I have a real affection for – specific parts of the kit, like the floor tom and the hi-hat. I just, I'm obsessed with those things and the way that they sound. And there's things on this record that, particularly with the hi-hat, because Jim and I have talked about the hi-hat a lot, and some of my favorite drummers, like Brendan Canty or Jim, or both Jim and I have a real appreciation for Billy Ficca from Television and the hi-hat playing on Marky Moon, which is like next level beautiful, you know? So
100%, yeah.
So there's certain parts of the drums that I just have this feeling for, and there's so many moments on this record, particularly between the floor tom and the hi-hat obviously the kick and the snare too, because there's these rattles on the snare and there's brush sounds. There's all of these like things that you can get really fetishistic about or have this really strong feelings about, and this record has, it's like a chocolate box of that kind of shit. It's like a Whitman sampler of these beautiful drum ideas, and it's like within, and yet they're contained within what I hear now as just like, you know, it's songs and also a song cycle. So it's like, I don't know, to me I'm so happy with it, and I find it so enjoyable to listen to on many levels, like as a piece of individual songs, as a song cycle, as separate sides, as individual nuggets of drum sonics. There's just, you know, to me it's like multi-level. There's so many kind of layers to it, and I worked on it and I know about it, and it still is a mystery to me, you know. It still has a quality of dreamlikeness that I don't quite understand where it comes from. And when the record ends with that click of the sticks at the end, it's like you're like shaken out of a, it like, it really gets, I feel like you can enter into a you know, it takes you into a different place. That there's there's a really a dreamlike quality to it, and I guess a quality of that memory trance that, you know, that when you really, really sit and listen and give it your attention, that it can put you there.
Yeah, and I don't mean to Steve Albini this situation, but you invoked engineering, and I think Jim described himself as engineering as well, perhaps. But it sounds like he's also more than dipped his toe into the notion of producing. There can be a distinction between the two, but I feel like you mentioned curtains and the sound of it. That's an engineering choice that Jim made, probably experimenting, maybe not knowing better. Maybe he wanted that rumble. But then the production, the playing around in Pro Tools, dropping things in and out, we're talking about Jim establishing himself as a producer, I think, as well. Is that fair, Guy?
And he is a producer on this record. Yeah. You know?
That's right. I mean, you're both credited as co-producing.
Yeah.
I mean, with that bass drum, for example, I mean, I spent a lot of time trying all the... I mean, you don't get to do that when you're in a studio making a record with hundreds of dollars an hour. There's all these people, you know... I mean, Guy and I do that, but also yeah. I did this a lot with the bass drum in my apartment. You know, and I remember that because I really liked this bass drum hits on this song, on this Chem Brothers song. So I actually wrote to Greg Norman, an engineer at Albini Studio.
At Electrical, yeah. And, Greg's a great guy. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I wrote to him and I said, hey, what microphone do you think you used on this record from like 20 years ago, you know? He goes, well, I think it was this. Pretty sure it was this, you know. And so I went and bought one, you know, and that's part of the sound. Yeah.
Yeah. Knowing Greg, if you couldn't find one, he'd build you one. That's how talented Greg is. So that's amazing in itself. Sorry, Guy, we never got to – I'm going to go back to you about this chronology thing in a moment. But perhaps more interestingly, Guy, you invoked George. There's a song here mm-hmm. called Walking the Block. And it features ostensibly the Slurist White configuration we've come to know and love. George, Jim, and Guy working together. This song, to me, I don't know, it makes me feel like I'm in crosstown traffic or something. It has this droney buzz to it. Just to clarify this for my own interest, what is the origin of that collaboration? Was it made for this record, or is it something that, not to suggest it was leftover, because that sounds unappetizing. But is it something that stems from sessions you had prior to working on this record?
It would. I mean, the thing about it is none of this music was made. Well, it's not, that's actually not true. But the intentionality of some of the early parts of the stuff that we were working on, it was unclear. We were just working, you know, and making songs and making sounds. And we were, at that point, the pandemic was in full glorious swing, so we were separated, and we had Jim and I had recorded a bunch of stuff in this kind of flurry of days, and that was a beat that we had kind of conceived of as this upbeat thing that we were working on, and we had a bunch of different versions of it, and at some point we sent it to George and Cree to fuck around with, just as like, you know, see what he had, and he sent me back ideas with Lute and ideas with Lyra and all these different kind of things, and we just kind of combed through those, and there was just one Lyra drone that he had put on there. The Lyra is a small bowed instrument that is, you know, it's really small. It's like, you know, like the size of a small baby's forearm or something like that. And it's so beautiful. And George has been playing it more and more lately. And it's just, his technique on it is just incredible. And if anyone gets the chance to see Zylorus White now, quite a bit of the material from the last record is involves the Lyra as well. So he's been playing it more. And so this was one instance where we had this piece and it just functioned so beautifully within it. And it fit on this record. And that's why it was there. So no, it's definitely not an outtake from thing. It was a piece of music that we had. And that happened to be an element that really worked with it.
Yeah. I appreciate that,
It's from a scene in the what's that movie called? Guy, do you remember Road? Road by Alan Clark, is it? That's where the title comes from.
Oh,
it's a scene. Where, yeah, it's a play. One of those sort of British TV play drama.
He's an incredible film director. He made
that one
Scum.
About football.
I think one of his more famous movies is Naked, but he's really famous for these tracking shots of people walking long distances and just really, really long tracking walking shots is kind of his signature. But I'd forgotten that it came from that. Because that's something, again, that Jim and I have kind of bonded over is that guy's movies. And you saw them in Australia, what, on the BBC or something like that?
No, I remember Jim saw it at the film anthology.
Oh, okay. Was that Christine, the one about the heroin addict kids walking back and forth between the houses?
It was the one about that town that was like totally down and out. They were just sort of hanging out, going out and walking around. He did a sort of soliloquy in that sort of walking the block. And then there was a double feature with that one about the football hooligans.
Hmm. Right. Yeah. Made in Britain, I think it's called.
It's fascinating to me that you've both invoked cinema or film, because you have done some scoring work. And to be honest, of the pieces, Walking the Block was the one that most sort of, I don't know why, for me, I was like, maybe this is from a Jem Cohen project or something they worked on. It felt like I felt an attachment to some sort of visual that I couldn't see with that particular tune. So that's fascinating in itself to me. You mentioned a name there. Instrumental music and naming conventions, always kind of fascinating. We've been talking about a song called July for some time, and unless I have a typo, is it J-U-L-L-Y, Jim?
Mm-hmm.
What is the spelling? So it's not the month that we're familiar with. Forgive me if I'm being an idiot and I just don't know what
means. It's fine.
What's the double L?
It's winter in Melbourne and summer in New York.
Is July with two L's?
One for
each. There's two Julys. They're quite different.
Really? I didn't. Wait a minute. You have two Julys?
Well, there's one in Melbourne. That's winter.
Yeah.
And there's one in America.
And there's
America,
one here that's summer.
I see. Okay. So did you make that up, or is that commonly known as having two L's?
No, I made it up.
Okay.
It could have had two J's, two U's, two L's, and two Y's, I guess.
It could have been July. That's okay. See, I'm kind of glad I asked that. I mean, and there's evocative names, St. Francis Place Setup, which, you know, we're talking about George's inclusion here. I think the only other occasion with a special guest. I hope I'm saying his name right. Is it Ben Boy?
Yeah, Ben Boy. I just, you know, I was stuck inside at one point in the pandemic, and I just wrote to Ben, his friend of mine, great piano player, and I just asked him to record a few chords, just single chords, just play the chord and then wait till it stops and then record another one, and just so I had something, because I was stuck in this room, you know, I just wanted to. And I used two of them in that song.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. And how do you know Ben?
I know him through Emmett Kelly, who I play with in The Double. We have a band called The Double. Yeah, he's just been around Chicago and LA. He's, you know, a good friend and musician.
Yeah, he plays with Will and other mutual
Correct.
Friends, I'm
yes.
sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, by and large, it's always fascinating when a couple of guests pop up on an otherwise solo record. So it sounds like it's just like happenstance for you, you both. Or sorry, back to George. Were you like, we got to have George on this record somehow? Was that a feeling you had, or
no?
It just happened.
No, we just wanted that sound on the, just happened.
Just like that. Mm. Yeah. Okay. So Guy, back to my question from 35 minutes ago about how things started. Sorry.
But it's interesting. Let me reframe your question a bit, because you asked about films and film soundtrack. And in fact, that was part of the origination of a lot of this new approaches was Jim and I. We've worked with, like you mentioned, Jem Cohen. We've worked with him on film projects before, and we're really quite interested in working with film and music in a way that's more interesting or something. And we talked about the idea of doing soundtrack work. And actually, around the time that this whole thing was bubbling up, we did get approached to work on a film by the actress and director Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Oh, wow.
Who made this film, The Lost Daughter. So she was interested. She'd heard Xylorus White. She was filming her movie in Greece. She was interested in working with the band on a soundtrack for that thing, and we were excited. I was particularly excited too, because I really was a huge fan of the Elena Ferrante, the woman who wrote The Lost Daughter, and she was famous for writing this Neapolitan trilogy.
Books. My wife loves those books. I need to dig in. They're really great, aren't they?
I think you absolutely should read them. I think they're just absolutely, you know, masterpieces, really. So interesting sociologically and historically, and the writing is so powerful, and it's like a narrative. It's really kind of addictive reading, but
yeah.
But we were really excited, and so this was at a point where we were all once again kind of sequestered in different parts of the world, but we got to work at, you know, putting stuff to the film, and ultimately it didn't end up, we didn't get the job or whatever, and we still don't know why exactly what happened, but I think maybe they were under a time crunch and they had to work with in quotes, professional person or something like that. So it ended up not working, but we never really found out why. But the good part of it was, I think it really, that kind of intensity of work that we generated for it, and the way that, I think it really kind of forced us to learn how to work in this new manner, and it opened up all these kind of possibilities. So I feel like there's something really interesting about ambient music, and there's something really interesting about soundtrack music, but there's also sometimes this feeling that it doesn't, you know, that it can't walk on its own legs in some kind of way. So I really feel like there's got to be a place for music that has that kind of, you know, expansive, or maybe more, I can't think of what the word is, but like it elucidates things in you, but it doesn't necessarily need some kind of external thing in order to stand on its own or whatever. And so there, because I think, Jim, we talked a lot about Brian Eno's ambient music. And for me also, there another parallel that I think about quite a bit in relation to this record, even though it's quite different, is, I don't know, are you familiar with Moondog, the street musician and composer from the 50s and 60s? He was a blind street musician in New York City who put out some records and was actually quite an incredible composer. And a lot of it is percussive. And then occasionally there's other instruments and some singing as well. But his stuff is really kind of rhythm based and so musical and so enjoyable. So I thought there were some parallels with that as well. But anyway, so that was all in the mix in terms of this chronology. We were working on film stuff as well as the film that became The Forest and Me. And also the record, The Forest and Me. So there was a lot of projects, I mean, almost too many projects to believe, all happening at the same time. We were working on the solo record. We were working on the Zellers White record. We were working on multiple film projects. It was just a really rich time. And I think all of these kind of projects kind of informed each other.
I think for anyone who's heard our previous conversations or you guys talk about your work together before, this is not going to come as a surprise. There always seems to be a little bit of juggling going on. And then each of the projects seems to inform the other on some level. You just invoke ambience. If memory serves, and forgive me if I have this wrong, Jim, there are pieces here that actually don't, it's called All Hits. Are there pieces here that actually don't have any drums? It's just you playing keys and synths, is that right?
No, there's a song called Soft Material that is predominantly keyboards, but there are some drums.
Right.
There are drums on there as well.
Okay, sorry. Maybe either my memory or my speakers aren't working, because I thought, I don't think I hear very much going on. And then I think Uncover Up has a particular ambience. Do you have an interest in what Guy was saying, I suppose, Jim, this notion of creating tones with the instruments you have?
Yeah, there was like, you know, so there was these cases where I was like playing the tunes on the keyboards, and there's somewhere I'm trying to match the tone of the floor tom. With like, you know, I'm just noticing that there's something going on there, and I'm sort of, you know, mixed it in to be lost, sort of joined up somehow. But yeah, it does seem like Brian Eno would be something you could talk about in regard to this record. You know, it's got nothing to do with Brian. It's like, it wasn't made in any way about that, but then once we try to contextualize it, you know, we're going to bring that in, you know.
Sure, I see. Yeah.
To me, the record is, I mean, it's great to hear Guy talk, like, because it does seem so like a dream almost, you know what I mean? But yeah, there's different ways of, no, I've got nothing else to say.
I'm going to bail on my attempts to talk about when things started, because I think we've covered a lot of ground here.
Mm.
Jim, do you have a sense if this project is going to prompt you to try something like this again, another record of your own?
Yeah, I think yes.
The short answer
Yes.
Yes. How how fleshed out are those plans as we're speaking, Jim?
Guy and I have started working on some, you know, been working on some stuff, you know, with that, talking about it.
Guy, can you shed any more light if I prod you?
Well, I mean, since I got to say, since Jim and I started working together, like, I don't know, 10, 11 years or whatever, something is always cooking, you know what I mean? Like, we're always have ideas, we're always sending ideas back and forth, talking about ideas, conceiving of things to do, you know, just going for walks and talking about what to do. I mean, Jim is a, you know, he's has, you know, he's got incredible stamina and energy, and he works on many, many different projects simultaneously. And I'm always kind of astounded by the variety of stuff that he's doing and the stuff he's involved in. But there's always this thread of us working together, and it's just, it's never not been fruitful. You know what I mean? It's just one of those things. Like, there's like, it's amazing. I think the experience of being, involved in music is always surprising to me. And I think it's been surprising me ever since I was like 15 years old. And the very first time I ever collaborated with someone else, like, that's when I really realized that for me, there's music that I make on my own that is really, really, personal and enjoyable for me. But what I really feel for me personally, when I really feel like music is at its most magic or whatever, is when you're working with someone else and when you find people that you have a certain kind of, that something is sparking off it, you know, and it's, 'cause it's always so surprising. I mean, if you can, you know, that's the thing, is like, you can surprise yourself, and you hope to always surprise yourself, but you're guaranteed to be surprised by someone else, you know, and that's really, I find, just, you know, awesome and great. And this relationship has been like that. And so for sure, I can't imagine us not trying to do more and come up with new ways. And Jim really has been pushing me. I think in some ways I'm a reluctant technician, but Jim's like kind of like passion for finding the right sound and pushing and developing ideas and it modifying the studio space here and modifying the approaches and stuff like that. It keeps me honest, you know, it keeps me kind of like invested and kind of pushing against my own, like, you know, calcification on that stuff.
He's upgrading you with each new venture.
Upgrading me, for sure.
So, Guy, in the context of Sclerus White, we've talked about your role as the producer, as someone who will figure out, you know, how these records are going to come together with them. That's been the primary role. I think the last time we were all gathered, I floated the notion, like, Guy, would you ever actually play with these folks? And I think, if I may paraphrase, correct me if I'm wrong, you've said, I don't think that's my place in that particular configuration. Does the, and again, forgive me if I'm misconstruing things, and correct me if you can. Either way, does working with Jim, and I don't see any evidence of it on this record, but would working with Jim potentially open you up to that, to being one of the guest instrumentalists or whatnot?
I mean, we have played music together, and I've also played music with Jim and George. Like, we've done live film scores as
live,
the three
yes,
of us.
Yes.
Like, we've done live performances with the three of us playing. I've done live performances multiple times with playing with Jim. So, I mean, it's just about the, you know, it's about the thing and understanding what serves the thing, you know?
Okay. So you dispute my claim that it's never occurred. I appreciate that. I think it sounds valid. I can't dispute it.
Your research department is...
gotta fire my research department here. I'm sorry, fellas. Jim, would you like to try to work with Guy as a musician a bit more? I mean, not simply in this role that you both seem to share as producers and collaborators. Would you like to play with him on a record?
Yeah. We've been toys in the air.
So cagey. Okay, I'm going to wait. I will all wait with bated breath to see what comes of this collaboration. As we wind down here, I want to ask a few things. Again, if I haven't conveyed it already, I love this album. Congratulations again. Jim, are you going to tour behind it, per se? Like, can you bring these songs, to these pieces, to life in some capacity?
Kind of looking at that to see how that feels, yeah.
Okay. And I presume you'd bring people along on stage?
I think that's, yeah.
Okay. Still in the works?
Yeah.
Okay. Beyond this project and potentially touring behind it, what are your other future plans at this moment? I haven't even had a chance to ask if there's Sclerus White activity, recording or live or anything like that. What else are you working on?
A lot. There's a new Dirty 3 record coming out.
Oh, amazing.
And it'll come out mid-year. And I have this new band with Steve Gunn, Shahzad Ismaili, and Zoamba. Are you familiar with them?
I saw Zoamba when I happened to be in Ontario last year at the Hillside Festival. Shahzad and I have an interesting history because when I was road managing a band in the year 2000, I heard tell that he drove them across the Brooklyn Bridge, steering with his feet and playing bass, an unplugged bass guitar, while driving them. They were petrified. They all came out. They were white guys, but they were whiter than they'd ever been, just white as ghosts. And I was like, what's wrong? And they're like, this guy, I don't know what. Anyway, I think we stayed at his house. So I know Shahzad from that, and we've been exchanging some emails because he apparently wants to talk to me, maybe about this story that I keep telling about him driving across the Brooklyn Bridge with his feet. And then Steve has been on the show. I'm a big fan. And I don't want to spill any beans, but Jim, I hear tell this configuration might actually be in Guelph, Ontario at the Hillside Festival this summer. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's not announced yet, but that's the word.
Yeah, that's what I heard too, and I'm contemplating a ticket home back to Ontario at least. I'm in my home, I guess, begrudgingly. I'm contemplating.
It's a great band. It's
yes.
A really, really incredible show. So I think, you know.
It'd be worth the airfare.
Absolutely worth the airfare.
Now,
yes.
Jim, you've been playing live, I see, based on social media with these folks. Is there a recording coming?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I appreciate the little glimmers of information, but this is all very, very exciting. That's great. So you got a full calendar as always. Is that fair, Jim?
And Marisa and I have a new album too.
It's funny you brought this up because Marisa and I tend to talk every year and they joked about it the last time we were on. And I was like, I haven't talked to Marisa in a long time. It feels like that's excellent. So that's great. That's probably a thrill jockey thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, I don't know when this goes to air, but they'll probably all be getting announced some point soon.
Yeah. It'll be closer to when this All Hits record comes out. So I don't think we'll be spilling too many beans, but Jim, thank you. Thank you for all of that.
Thank
That's
you.
Great. I'm
thank
so
you.
Excited.
Thank you for your interest.
Jim, before I move on to Guy, if people want to learn more about you on the social media and whatnot, where would you like to send them?
Oh, I have a website, if I remember to update it, jimwhitedrums.com.
Okay. That's the central hub these days.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. As yes.
Everything crumbles. Okay. Guy, similar questions. Plans. Anything coming up?
I have stuff coming up, but nothing I can discuss. So, but it's just so exciting that maybe you'll have to book me again next year so we can hash it all out. But yeah.
Okay. Here's my intuition is telling me we're a year away from something. You just said next year, so it's not. Is it going to be sooner than next year, whatever you're working on?
I don't know. I really don't know.
But that's exciting. I don't know if it's exciting, actually. You could be planning to build a deck or something. I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, I thought you were going to say death ray. I'm planning to build a death ray and a deck to hold my death ray.
Well, no, that's exciting. You know, Guy, some of us wonder what you're up to in that studio of yours. So you're working on something. Is it musical? Could you say it's at least musical?
I can't even go that far. I can't even go that far to say that.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
What about Sclerus White related? Are you? I know you're kind of the gatekeeper of all the stuff that comes in. any plans for new music by that duo?
There most certainly will probably be. Yeah. I mean, we're always in the hunt.
You know, it's funny. The last time you guys were on, the three of you, I said, I wrote you after. Do you guys get a group photo? And you were all like, no. Like with Guy, I mean, there were promo photos of Jim.
We found one, actually. We found a really good one.
I know. It happened after my episode came out. I saw like two, you had said on the episode, actually, George is going to be here and we're going to do some, there's going to be some shows. I don't know if Jim, somebody took a photo of you three, right? In some capacity, like a new one. And I was like, damn it. I mean, it's fine. I was thwarted, but I am glad that maybe I planted that seed. We should probably get a photo of the three of us. So anyway, that's great. And Guy, if people want to learn about you, I know there's nowhere to go.
You can commune with me in the dream world, kind of meet me there on the astral plane.
Okay.
As the genius Jonathan Richmond said.
Yes. So. Oh my God. I love Jonathan Richmond. Okay. All right. If we've covered everything else, this record is out on Drag City. It's called All Hits Memories. I wonder if we can go out on a tune. Based on Guy's reticence to engage in musical debates, I will not suggest there will be any debate here. I will simply suggest that I will ask one of you to pick the song, and we'll see where we go. Jim, it's your party. It's your record. If you can pick a song for us to go out on, what would it be and why?
Let's do Soft Material.
Soft Material. This is a collaborative co-write between you and Guy, I see here in my notes. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So how does I didn't really ask you this, and I don't want to go on and on. When certain songs are attributed to the both of you, let's focus on this one. How do you work together on this particular song? Guy, I'm going to go to you. What's the nature of the collaborative framework of Soft Material?
I mean, this kind of attribution stuff is a little tricky. I mean, I there's some songs where there was more arrangement and kind of compositional work that we shared, and then that would be how we would describe the thing. And then there's other songs that were more not that. So that's really, the extent of it. So we just sat down and looked at the list of songs and tried to recreate how they were conceived and how they became themselves. And then, and that's that.
Okay. Why do you suppose, Guy, why do you suppose Jim picked this song? Do you have a sense of it? I'm going to ask him. He's here with us, luckily.
I think because it's just an incredibly beautiful song.
Okay.
I think it's, and it's very unique, even within the record itself. And I think it's
a hit.
It'll probably lead to people having a good feeling. So
okay.
that would be good.
Jim, did you want to say anything more about why you chose Soft Material?
No.
That's what I thought was going to happen. Okay, let's hear it now. This is Soft Material by Jim White from this brilliant new record, All Hits, Memories. It's out on Drag City, and it's a lovely. Jim, Guy, for what it's worth, I love you both very much. Thank you for making time for me always and engaging.
Oh, if I can just say one more thing, because I'm looking at the cover of the record. It's a beautiful design by Jim's sister Anna, and do you have an actual copy which has a record sleeve?
No, I don't have it yet.
I think people will be very pleased to own the physical item because it's another one of those things. It's very similar to music when you're putting all the elements together and you're looking at them and then you're hoping that they survive the industrial process. And then when like a sleeve like this comes out and then the mastering comes out and then the pressing of the record comes out and it all is what you most hope for and envisioned, then you are very happy. And that's what happened in this case. I just think it's just such a beautiful record. So I think people should, when they go to their record stores, just look for the most beautiful sleeve in the shop and you will have found the record.
I will say, even digitally, I've been compelled by the cover, at least. I haven't seen the back of it, obviously, or anything like that. Jim, your sister Anna seems to often take photos of you as well and clearly now has a graphic design thing that I wasn't maybe aware of. Is this a professional?
And she shot the video for Marketplace as well, which people can see on the YouTube.
On the YouTube. Okay, nice plug for the people at the YouTube. Jim?
And Red Wine. Also, she's done covers. We've worked together our whole lives. She did many record covers for Venom P. Stinger and other things.
And this is her, is that her career, so to speak? Is this what she does?
Yes,
she makes things?
She's a visual artist, yeah.
Oh, nice. Well, that's lovely. This is a real family affair. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the song again. Soft Material, Jim White, All Hits, Memories, Jim and Guy. Always a pleasure for me. Thank you for indulging with my rambling questions. And thank you for being on my show. And best of luck in the future. Jim, maybe I'll see you in Guelph this summer.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Vish. You're a good friend.
What a lovely piece of music that is. Jim is such a lovely guy, and I'm so happy for him that he finally put out a solo record, because he just seems to have a lot of great ideas. And it's so nice to have him and Guy working together. What a pleasure. I just feel very grateful to Jim and Guy. I admire them so much, and I hope you enjoyed that conversation. And I want to thank them again for appearing on this, the 849th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One Podcast Network and is available almost wherever you get your podcasts. If you are looking for an episode and you can't find it, or you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkhanna.com. There's also a link in the show notes that says follow Vish online, and that is what you might imagine. If you click on that Linktree thing, you'll see links to my various presences on various social media platforms, so feel free to follow me there and or whatever. Most importantly to me these days is the Patreon. I hope you will visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep myself going and keep the show going. As you've heard already, I think I've made my case a little bit about what's going on these days with me. I've tried to make the tiers on that Patreon appealing to you. So as I've stressed before, at $4 and up, ad-free early episodes. $6 and up, bonus content. $10 and up, all what I just said, plus you get entered into these random prize draws I've been doing to give away stuff at the end of each month. So I hope those are appealing to you as perks. And I hope you, if you have the means, and only if you have the means, to spare some money for me and the show, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol and support the show today. Thank you so much. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks, as always, to my dear friend Jim Guthrie. He lends me some music for the show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Jim and Guy. I hope you found it interesting, and we'll check out this beautiful album they've made together, All Hits Memories, out on Drag City. Thanks for subscribing to this podcast and telling your friends about it. I don't like fishing for compliments, but honestly, leaving a nice rating and a nice review helps the show gain more exposure on those platforms where you're leaving those reviews. So yeah, again, I'm not looking for, I appreciate it. There's been so many nice ones lately, so thank you for that. But yeah, if you can do that, that would be great. Otherwise, do nothing at all. Just be yourself. I will talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.